Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Midrats. If you are with us live, I would encourage you to go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the page where you will find the chat room. That's especially important today because this is the ever famous and called for Midrats Melee format. We don't have any guests today, and we don't have a set topic. So if there's something you would want us to talk about, or you wish we had a show on, but we never did, hop in the chat room, put it in there. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. Or if you're really feeling adventurous, you can always call the switchboard. You can reach us at 347-308-8397. It's right there on the show page. You're with us live. You don't need for me to repeat that. And, hey, we're just going to roll right into the show. And I'll start things off by saying I don't know how long my voice is going to last. As some of y'all may know, down here in the deep south, we've been hit with a whole bunch of storms. And some of my trees decided they had had enough of their mortal coil. And so I spent a lot of the day yesterday with a chainsaw in hand, and it was either the pine tree or the persimmon. One of the two irritated my vocal cords. So hopefully my co-host is feeling chatty. So Eagle One, good afternoon.
Oh, am I supposed to talk today? I thought it was your show.
We are a semi-autonomous commune, whatever the phrase is from. Monty Python, Anarcho-Syndicus Commune, is that it? I think it might be.
I don't know. I'm always laughing too hard at that point to know exactly what they've ever said.
Yeah, well, we always wait for the violence inherent in the system, which is perfect for our show. And, you know, one of the fun things about doing a melee, our illustrious guest and our listeners don't know this, we usually have a pre-show chat and a post-show chat just with the two of us, and occasionally our guests are joined in, and sometimes that will go for almost the length of the show, or until one or both of our wives come and grab us by the ear and make us come to dinner, one of the two. So there's always plenty to talk about, and sometimes in the early years of the show when we wouldn't have a guest, I would go, oh gosh, what are we going to talk to? But the fates always manage to hand us a series of things to talk about. And one of the things I keep mentioning to people about a variety of things recently is what I call the stickiness of history, where kind of the same vein that Mark Twain said, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes. And there are things, and you know, what we've talked about many times during the years, is the absolute critical importance of properly teaching world history, not just American history, but world history, because you see patterns and reasons that if your historical knowledge base is only, if you're lucky, inside your adult years, you're going to miss it. And whether you're talking about what we're seeing in Minsk and other places in Belarus, you know, why is that white and red flag out there? Or from a nautical standpoint, back to the for a running history of a few thousand years, ramming has come back into play in the nautical arena of warfare or quasi-warfare or non-warfare with the Turks and the Greeks off of Cyprus. And I think for a lot of people that are interested in the the hydrocarbon aspects of the near to land littoral, if we can use that phrase, the legal aspects of it. And when you throw in inside of living memory for many people, the island of Cyprus that the Cypriot Greeks and the Turks back in the mid-70s got to a squabble over when Turkey invaded the northern portion. And what caught your eye today, this week, when you saw the Greeks and the Turk decide to do a little dancing?
Well, you know, they have so much history. I mean, you know, the Turks used to own, the Ottoman Empire used to own a big chunk of the real estate where Greece is. And they've never been good neighbors. They've never really embraced and kissed and hugged. You know, they're both part of NATO. I don't know how the NATO planners do it. You probably know better than I, but hardly ever do you find the Greeks and the Turks, in my experience, in the same room during a discussion of NATO topics. Part of the issue that Turkey has, it is almost, and this is, I used to work in the oil and gas industry, so this is kind of where my framework comes from. Turkey has almost no domestic production of oil and gas. Here are all these other countries in the Middle East that are just sitting on tons of stuff. Turkey's got virtually nothing. So they have to import a huge amount of their oil and gas. Off the coast of Cyprus, in between Cyprus, Israel, Lebanon, and Egypt, there's this huge field, Leviathan field of natural gas that's been discovered. And everybody wants to exploit it, particularly those countries that are exclusive economic zone and other parts of the things we recognize under agreements like the United Nations Law of the Sea, UNCLOS document, which Turkey, by the way, never signed. All these countries would like to exploit this natural gas. So Israel wants to develop it. Egypt wants to develop it. Greeks would like to see it developed. And then you get into the question of, well, who really owns that part of the ocean? And Turkey says, well, we own a big section of it. And the Greeks say, well, not so fast. And part of it is that off the coast of Turkey are all these islands, and most of them are owned by Greece. And they're not off the coast like 100 miles. They're like 3 miles off the coast or 5 miles off the coast. So if you go to Rhodes, I used to do that when I was a kid, you get on a ferry boat from Marmaris in Turkey, and you go over to Island Rhodes, and you were in Greece. And there are a whole bunch of these islands, and if you are, you know, it depends on how you define Greece. This gets into these weird questions: is Greece an archipelagic state? I don't think I said that right, or is it just a state that has islands? And you know, that makes some difference in how you measure the national waters of Greece and all that. The Turks say, look, you know, the way this should work is there ought to be a fair distance from our shore that belongs to us. And yeah, you have a couple of islands that are in that, but that doesn't mean that our rights don't extend beyond those islands. You can't use these islands as a basis for claiming the entire Eastern Mediterranean. And the Greeks are saying, well, that's obviously not the case because islands count. Islands count as just like Hawaii counts the United States. As part of our territory and gives us certain rights at sea out in that part of the world. They say we've got those same rights with our islands in the Mediterranean. And of course the issue of Cyprus, which as you note, 1974, the Turks invaded Cyprus, took the northern half, and then you have another country, I guess, the southern part of Cyprus, which is the Republic of Cyprus, I believe. You know, they have a claim to this to the exclusive economic zone off their shores, but the Turks don't want to recognize these things. The Turks are also trying to make a deal with the Libyan two current Libyan governments, and the one the Turks are supporting is the one that says, well, you know, we've got these exclusive economic zone rights, and they extend out to this point, which is just off the tip of the island of Crete in the middle of the Mediterranean. And the Turks say, yeah, our EEZ extends out there too, and our EEZ is joined together right there off the tip of Crete. And of course, the Greeks are Crete is a Greek island. Your EEZ can't extend to where our island is, and it and as some wag on Twitter said, Turkish claims make perfect sense as long as you pretend that neither Cyprus or Crete exists. But the whole thing, this is all being driven by the need the Turks have to have some natural resource that they could exploit. So, you know, we've had all these wars for oil and gas in the past, and to my limited way of thinking, this looks like exactly one of those. The Israelis and the Egyptians want to run a pipeline, natural gas pipeline, on the seabed of the Mediterranean up into Europe, and they could then be a counterbalance to the Russians, who are currently trying to get a monopoly on their provision of gas to Northern Europe. So the Russians are supporting, and it's difficult to tell with the Russians sometimes, but they seem to be supporting a group that would not want the situation on the seabed of the Mediterranean to be clarified. Of course, the Russians are also supporting the forces in Syria, and they have a naval base in Lebanon, and it just gets more and more messed up the more you look at it. It's just it's a tough situation, but I personally think that it's being driven by this huge natural gas field that the Israelis and the Greeks and the Egyptians like to exploit.
I think among modern nations, the whole Turkish-Greek relationship is one of the most irritatingly dysfunctional. One of my favorite stories about this is just how petty things can get. We had, back when I was a NATO schmo, we had a Turkish colonel coming to brief our staff on some operations that they were doing. And he got up there to give his presentation. Well, we were also being visited, like we were on a regular basis. The Eurocorps, the EU's military staff, is in Strasbourg. And we did a lot of stuff with them because when Eurocorps showed up, they were usually, Europeans. we all knew each other. We're all wearing the same uniforms. Turkey is not in the EU. And so the Turkish colonel got about 6 or 7 words into the brief and stopped. And he pointed over to this Greek colonel who had come up with the Eurocorps. And the Turkish colonel only knew this because we had just all had coffee together. And he said, "This brief is only releasable NATO. You have to leave." And he's like, "Greeks is in NATO." It's like, "But you are for the EU. This is not releasable to the EU. You need to leave." And so the Europeans just stared off into the distance, and the Americans and Canadians were all looking at each other like, "Should we laugh or just be quiet?" We had no idea. But, I mean, that's kind of the way they are. And I think that what we're seeing off of Cyprus is exactly what you described. Plus, it's a perfect opportunity for Erdogan, how he pronounces his name, to keep pushing his little militaristic nationalist drum. What he's done in Syria, what he has done in Libya. And I think there's a connection between what's going on in Libya and another little aspect that I found very interesting this week about what's happening in Cyprus. As there was, I wish I had the details. I could probably Google it during the show, but it's out there if anybody wants to look it up. There was an incident off of Libya with a Turkish merchant and a French, I believe it was a French or Italian or French and Italian, naval ship that wasn't very nice and professional. And we also saw the French, who after the Beirut explosion, had an opportunity to step in what used to be, and probably you consider still is, part of their sphere of influence for the last almost 1,000 years in the Eastern Mediterranean. They sent a couple of fighter jets over to the Greek Cypriot air base, just a couple, but it made a statement So, of course, the UK has two permanent military bases on Cyprus. The French have got a couple of planes there now. And we had a Greek frigate and a Turkish frigate decide to play bumper cards at each other. So there's a lot of posturing and huffing and puffing. I think the odds are greatly in the favor that that's all it's going to be. But as we both know, it takes only one bad combination of people on watch at 0200 to take stupidity to a different level.
Yeah, and to kind of go along with what you were saying, the French, and I was just looking at this, and of course my machine starts doing the magic circle stuff when the Turks are supporting the UN supported government of Libya. And the French and the UAE and a bunch of other countries are supporting the other group. And so that's, you know, we've got this tension going on there. The Turks and the French are already hacked off at each other. A few years ago, a Turkish, may have been a general, I can't remember, it was an admiral, but came up with the concept of the Blue Nation. So he has done sort of what, or did sort of what China has done in the South China Sea. The theory was that Turkey is a maritime power and has a blue interest in this area around Turkey that, you know, is part of, makes them a blue nation, if you will. And I could get my computer to work right, I would reveal his name and all kinds of good stuff. Anyway, the point is that they've taken on this concept that they have more rights at sea than other people have been willing to grant them. And the situation under UNCLOS is it depends on whether you use a distance. If you took all the conformal shape of an island, say, and you ran your distances from each aspect of it, you know, so if it's 3 miles, every part of that island's would have a 3 mile or 6 mile or 12 mile limit around it. And of course that bumps into somebody else's limit, and then you go through where they meet in the middle, and that's going to be your international boundary. But that in some instances, the islands that are owned by Greece, as I said earlier, are so close to Turkey that would create some serious issues for Turkey. They would have a 1 mile or less territorial limit in some of the waters. So, you know, that they don't look on that very favorably. Since they got rejected by the EU, or they're still pending, I never have quite figured out where we are with that, and Erdogan has gone on his nationalist fervor and is making friends with, or if I would say making friends, he wants a bigger role in the Middle East than that Turkey has had up to now. And it's interesting how he's been playing that card with respect to Syria. But in this particular instance, he's got an ancient enemy in Greece. He's got this potential for a vast amount of wealth and energy power that would be useful to the Turks. And you know, you can just see that the claims are going to be ugly for a while. Now, Erdogan has said, as others, you know, why don't we negotiate? And the question, if you're the Greeks, is negotiate about what? You know, this we're living with international law. Now, some lieutenant colonel, Greek lieutenant colonel, was at the American, I think it was at the Air Force Command and Staff School. You know, kept referring in this in his thesis to basically the absurd claims made by Turkey. That's which, you know, he didn't lay a whole lot of background for that. He just kind of laid it out that way. So, you know, this is going to be a sticky thing for quite a while. If they're going to willing to trade paint with opposing their opposing forces, then you've got a mini thing like a mini version of what we used to do with the Russians when we would shoulder them aside from things we didn't want them to play with. So. And the Turks have sent a drill ship to test the waters, and the Greeks are saying, hey, you're testing the waters in our national international and our national waters, and that's not going to stand. So this has the potential to escalate. I don't know how you de-escalate it once all these things have been laid out, but I assume that if you threw enough money and gave them some right to some of the gas in the Leviathan field, that the Turks might be a little happier than they are right now. And the other thing is that the U.S. is going to be involved because Chevron, the massive oil and gas company for which I used to work, by the way, has bought Noble, or has been in the process of trying to buy Noble Energy, which is the one who has been exploring the Leviathan field off Israel and Cyprus.
Yeah, it's funny, the whole, let's negotiate. It's like, you woke up in the morning and your neighbor has had a fence put 5 feet into your property that y'all have been living next to for decades. And he goes, well, I just think this looks better. And you're like, that's my property. Well, let's negotiate. Like, no, get your fence off my property. Don't make me fight you. Yeah, it does get a little otherworldly there. And I found the incident I talked about before. This actually took place over the July 4th weekend. I'll do a little long quote from Reuters. Quote, the incident unfolded quickly in the Eastern Mediterranean on June 10th. June 10th, not July 4th. But it was when the article was written. Anyway, back to the quote. When a French frigate under NATO command tried to inspect a Tanzanian-flagged cargo ship suspected of smuggling arms to Libya in violation of a UN embargo, the French Armed Forces Ministry, speaking on behalf of the government, said the frigate was harassed by three Turkish naval vessels escorting the cargo ship. The Turkish ship flashed its radar lights, whatever that is, and put on bulletproof vests and stood by their light weapons, it said. Turkey disputes this. It denies trafficking arms to Libya. It says the cargo ship, the Kirkin, was carrying humanitarian aid. It has accused the French Navy of aggression. Turkey's ambassador to France, a guy I can't pronounce, said on July 1st, the three Turkish warships were helping NATO enforce the UN arms embargo. NATO ordered an investigation, but its contents are classified, and NATO has not commented on its outcome. Two European diplomats told Reuters that France sent a letter to NATO General Jens Stoltenberg in early July saying the report did not, quote, correctly establish the facts, unquote. This is almost comical European and Turkish behavior. We're going to huff, we're going to puff, we're going to write letters to each other and send stern diplomatic notes. But that's better than shooting at each other, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as long as there's no reason not to talk, but you don't have to agree. I mean, it's, I don't think I'd want to be the arbitrator in the middle of this mess, but it's just the way it goes sometimes. You just, and especially when there's so much money involved. The blue homeland,
yeah.
That's the concept I was trying to get. It was pretty interesting idea.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that concept before.
Yeah, let's see. Where did I get this? Coining the term the blue homeland ultimately represents more than an act of political branding. To a large extent, it signals a somewhat dramatic shift in doctrine within Turkish political and military circles. It's not too long ago that Turkish strategic thinking were associated with transitions in administration. However, the Navy's former chief of staff has been associated, let's see, his name is Cihat Yaci. I think that's how you'd say it. And the idea was formulated by Turkish Rear Admiral Cem Gürdeniz. So, anyway.
We need to get Saturn V to come on here on a regular basis so he can tell us how to pronounce this stuff.
Well, you'd think having lived over there, I would know how to do that, but it was a long time ago. In fact, long before 1974.
Well, and you know, it plays right into to kind of what I made an offhand comment at the beginning. You know, history is sticky. When we're looking at that flag in Minsk, that goes back to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It at various times went from the Baltic to the Black Sea, included a lot of present-day Belarus, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, et cetera, and so forth. You look at the Visegrad group, mostly interconnected culturally to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Those nations, minus Poland, pretty much all of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire, inside, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Austria, Croatia, they all coordinated their border control during COVID. And here we have Turks playing around with the old Ottoman footprint again. It really is amazing how these things, regardless of whether it's been a century or how many generations go past, that when there's a unsettling and a reshuffling and parts start moving, they start settling in these old grooves again. That's just fascinating. And no wonder the Egyptians aren't too happy about it.
Yeah, well, speaking of odd things going on with NATO, we announced troop withdrawals from Germany, and you have more experience with NATO than I have, but Germany has not been complying with their NATO requirements, and what do we do with the troops? Well, we put a big chunk of them in Poland. Poles apparently really happy to have U.S. troops helping them out as they face east again. What do you think about that? Is this NATO going the way it should? You know, if you're not going to play in NATO very well, and you're not going to maintain your armed forces very well, should some of the other members say, okay, well, if you're not going to play, we're going to move with somebody who really is more interested in what the purpose of NATO started out to be?
I think we have to. And, full disclosure, regulars here know, I'm in a strange place. I love Germany. I love Germans, but they piss me off. I saw this in spades. On the light side, it was almost a joke. Whenever in NATO you had to fill out, whether it was in Afghanistan or someplace else, or for an exercise, or even just a game, when you fill out your CJSOR, your Combined Joint Statement of Requirements, where you do your troops to task. Okay, here's what we want to do. This is the type of forces we're going to need. We need 3 armored brigades. We need 4 hospital units. We need X number of ships, Y number of planes, whatever. There's a bidding process where nations will say, we can fill this, we can fill that, we can fill that. And the toothy bits would inevitably not be picked. And it was a running joke. Well, the Americans will fill it. Well, the Americans will fill it. We saw that with the Aviation Bridging Force in Afghanistan in the summer of 2007. That was a classic real world example. And if you push the Germans too much, they'll pop out their bottom lip and start talking about, militarism and our special history, blah, blah, blah. We're at least a generation and a half, 2 generations past, I think, still washes what they're happy with. Is they're happy having their national security guaranteed by the Americans, where we'll spend and we'll garrison their country, so they only have to spend half of what they really should as a continental power. And at the same time, they're helping to finance NATO's primary potential threat, which is Russia, with this corrupt Gazprom meets Nord Stream pipeline that literally is run by the last SDP chancellor of Germany and a guy who used to be up in the top ranks of the East German Stasi. And all that money is being siphoned right into their pockets and Russia. And Germany has decided to use COVID as excuse to say, you know, we had this path to get to percent of GDP sometime near the crack of doom, but we're not going to do that anymore. While Poland is right at 2%, also Poland, from a personal point of view, the Poles absolutely positively love Americans. You'll run into anti-American Poles just like you will anyplace else in the world, or heck, you know, here in the U.S., Americans who are anti-American. But the Poles, to a person, they all got a relative in Illinois, or it seems. And if you're a young man or a woman who wants to see Europe on an enlisted person's paycheck, it's pretty cheap to live in Poland. There's incredibly I think it's great to see. It does acknowledge the fact that NATO's eastern frontier has moved the country to the east. And I heard that by doing that, we help tamp down some of the insecurity that the Poles rightfully have given their history about their allies. And that insecurity is tapped into by some of the less than savory nationalist forces in Poland. And so if we can give the Polish nation a little more security in the fact that you're in NATO and we're here for you, it might help the brighter lights and civic culture in Poland to focus on continuing to build a nation that just has tremendous potential.
Yeah. I mean, I got to work with them a little bit when I was involved with the Kosovo thing, and I really enjoyed working with them. They were, that was a long time ago, and they were kind of in the early stages of really beginning to feel their oats as out from under the boot, so to speak, of the former Soviet Union. But they were just, boy, they were so happy to be messing around with NATO. You know, just. I've never seen happier folks to deal with Americans and to do whatever they could do to make life easier for the people they were working with.
I worked with a Polish colonel, paratrooper type, and overindulgence of adult beverages after an exercise, he and a couple of the Germans. And a scattering of other folks were all sitting around the table, and he was drawing out on literally cocktail napkin of where they were going to attack from the Baltic coast of Germany inside of Denmark, that little curl, and all their plans, and where, you know, he trained his battalion and all the little towns, and it was funny, but the Poles are good folks.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, that's a good move. Then the other thing I thought we ought to talk about, to segue a little bit, is China seems to be backing off a little bit. We're not going to shoot first in the South. That's always reassuring to me. We're not going to shoot first in the South China Sea. And they've made claims that they've been a little too aggressive. They're facing some serious issues with the flooding that's going on and their food supply and a lot of other things that are going to need some help from the rest of the world if things really turn south for them. But in addition to that, are they just saying this stuff, do you think, and waiting for our election to see if they're going to get a softer, gentler administration to deal with?
Here's my take, and I'm not the person who invented this. I think they're better strategic thinkers. They had to come to Jesus meeting with some people, because we saw with COVID, the Chinese played their hand a little too early. Their whole wolf warrior diplomacy crew got out really aggressive. And their military and their military might, and especially on the naval side of the house, they're following the very successful, and this was, I could be wrong, but I think this is from Deng Xiaoping fought that when they were building their economy, they wanted to be in the background, wanted to be humble. They wanted to constantly, you know, downsell themselves, you know, oh, we're just a poor, primitive country. You know, we need this injection molding equipment. Or, oh, you know, Germany, we're so sorry. I'll tell you what, we'll buy this entire factory outside of Dusseldorf and ship it back to China. Or Ukraine, you have this little carrier there. We're just going to turn into a casino. So you be quiet, you be humble, you don't brag, but you build and you get strong. And they've done this with their economic might in the last few years. When you reach a critical mass, then the mask comes off and you use this newfound power, in this case it's been economic power, to promote your national interest against people who aren't inclined to do it out of the goodness of their heart. That's what the Chinese are doing with their economic power. They are behind in their military power, but they're growing substantially, but they're not at that point now that they can be really pugnacious and aggressive, because if somebody called their bluff, they don't have the credibility quite yet. They're close. If you held a gun to my head, I said they're about 75% of where they need to be before they can dig in their heels a bit here and there. And that was recognized after COVID hit. And I think you're seeing this walk back because they went, hey, guys, we jumped the gun here. Let's back off. We've got a few more years, and then we'll do what we need to do. So that's my take. So I think that's really smart on China's part. And it gives their economic and their diplomatic corps the ability to help change the facts on the ground in a lot of places they're interested in South Asia, South Pacific, and Africa. So, yeah, I think it's the Chinese aren't doing that out of the goodness of their heart. I think it's their more power-minded, smart strategy leaders grabbed everybody by the collar and pulled them back.
Well, they don't have a whole lot of allies. I mean, they've managed to scare everybody. The Japanese are scared. The South Koreans are nervous. The Philippines, Duarte, I don't know what he is, but you know, he knows he's got some issues. He's trying to feed the dragon and feed the tiger and while riding on his back. I'm not sure that's a wise move, but you know, he's also got help now from the Japanese, from the U.S. and some other folks. He's got the Australians nervous. As we talked to the guy a couple of weeks ago, has announced and India is, India is not a happy group of people either with China. And I can't believe the border contra comps that they've had to endure with and maybe China will back off on that too. But this Belt and Road thing, I think, and people begin to see that if you don't pay your bill and they try and take over your port, that maybe these really aren't the best agreements they could negotiate. I think maybe somebody finally said, look, maybe our approach was a little too aggressive on this. This is not 1888 or whatever it was when a lot of the great powers were running around taking over the world.
It's funny, one of the more entertaining exchanges I had this week on Twitter was some Pogue bot, who knows who it was, because I made some comment about Chinese imperial ambitions. And they said, in reply, but you hear this a lot, there's something imperialistic about China. They're moving into these countries and they're building ports, building roads, they're financing projects, they're building factories. And I was like, that's what empires do when they take over areas. They build roads and infrastructure because that's how you extract resources. You can call it whatever you want to. If I come in with my security forces, I'm building roads that I'm securing and ports that I'm securing. And we're financing agriculture that's coming to my nation. You can call it what you want to, but that's imperial. And we're doing it by corruption that would make the East India Company look shy.
Yeah. Well, I was the other thing this last week, the poor Ecuadorians and trying to defend the Galapagos from the Chinese fishing, I don't even know what to call it, monster. You know, the big fleet the Chinese send to strip the ocean of fish. I don't know what they plan to do when they've completely destroyed the fish stocks in the world. What are they going to live on? Soylent Green?
Yeah, probably. Just like other nations who have strip mined, the North Atlantic cod and everything else, they'll pull the last fish out and then they'll panic. They're not unrelated to it. I want to send a little love to Scott and Paul. They did bring something up in the chat room that I wanted to point something to them to if they haven't looked at the Heritage. They're asking about shipyards. Let me see exactly what Paul and Scott. Scott said the expansion, using expansion of naval shipbuilding is one element of a longer stimulus program to industrialize America. And the Heritage Foundation, one of their research assistants, and if I'm mispronouncing her name, that's okay. Maya Clark, N-A-I-Y-A. Note, parents, please do not use inventive spelling. You confuse people when you use inventive spelling for your kids. I probably just insulted her because it's Ukrainian or something. Anyway, Maya Clark is what I'll call her. It's U.S. Navy shipyards desperately need revitalization and a rethink. And I won't obviously read the whole thing, but the key takeaways, the outline, the opening takeaway one, as the United States returns to great power competition, it will need to rely more heavily on its Navy to defend the nation's strategic interests around the world. Two, to meet this challenge, Navy leaders must focus on modernizing and configuring America's four existing public shipyard requirements. And three, the choices the Navy leaders make today to prioritize Navy shipboard modernization or not will have an outsized impact on Navy readiness and national security. Maybe we need to get Ms. Clark on to talk about it in more detail. I would recommend it to everybody to give a read. It has a nice graph, but it's something we talk about on a regular basis here. And all you have to do is look what the Chinese are doing. They can't build shipyards fast enough to keep up with the number of ships that they're building. They're making this investment while whatever model we're using just isn't quite cutting the mustard, especially on the West Coast.
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to look back, I'm sure, and you and I have discussed this, probably beating this horse to death, but it's still going to linger. LCS decisions, the amount of money we have poured into, and they may be great ships, the Zumwalt, whatever they are, I call them cruisers, but they probably have some function down the road. I mean, we spent so much on these things, and I think it broke us. I think it's, if you're going to build destroyers, well, we had a really good destroyer design in the Burke class, and nothing wrong with continuing to build those and upgrade, just continue to build variations of those until you come up with something a whole lot better. And I don't see that happening, and we're going to replace, we're going to have some frigates, which is great when he does. And we need to if you build enough of things. I mean, this is the F-35 lesson. Even though it's an expensive program, if you build enough aircraft, pretty soon you get the cost per aircraft down to some reasonable number. Whereas if you build a few, even if things that are expensive, then you're not distributing the cost over a large enough quantity to make each unit reasonably priced, and also you can't start a project without knowing what the components are going to be before you get done with, you can build the ship, but, you know, where are the modules? We're still waiting for all the modules for the LCS, and even if we get them, but by the time we get them, I don't know what's going to happen to those ships. So anyway, yeah shipbuilding.
Being that we're dragging out dead horse.
Okay.
Sorry. While we're dragging out dead horses, we like to beat, one of the most depressing moments I had last week in this part of my life is, again, we've talked about tons of times, former guest of Midrat, Don Rumsfeld, the whole transformational era in ERA and ERROR that was made in the opening years of this century that we're still paying for nowadays. You can draw the line, LCS, DDG 1000, even LPD 17 and Ford, that with enough money you can fix almost any problems, the failure of CGX, et cetera, et cetera. We all know the story here. All of that, a lot of that, derived from a senior leadership cadre that bought in to the industry BS lies that overpromised and underdelivered, papered over technology and program risk, and promised everybody that certain things were right around the horizon, and it's going to give us an opportunity to, which offset are we on now? 4, 5, 6? Who knows? We'll be able to leap generations ahead and be able to do more with less, et cetera, and so forth. And at the end of the day, when you had to make shadows on the ramp and displace water, it was a lie. And we restart DDG 51 pipe production line. We suck it up and say, okay, we'll take a traditional frigate because at least it can fight. And there was a interview with Michelle Flournoy, who we've heard since, I think, the first year, heard of since the first year we started doing mid-rights a decade ago, the once and future next Secretary of Defense. I don't know whether if Biden wins, she'll actually take the job, because she's, from what people tell me, she's making some pretty good cheese in the consultancy world. But she, who is very influential in the Democrat national security arena, you would have thought she was frozen in 2002 and reanimated. Everything she was talking about, but with just a little more of AI thrown in, was that same mindset that we need to stop spending on what they derisively call legacy. I call things I can go to war with in 5 years. We need to stop doing that and invest more informational, unmanned, AI-driven warfare. We've talked about everything from electromagnetic spectrum to the problems with AI as it's now programmed, satellite. It's almost as if she has never been in a room with somebody who would challenge her. And if we have next year a new administration with either Michelle Flournoy or people influenced by her taking the reins again, we're going to lose another generation. Another generation of opportunity, while the Chinese, they're going to lap us. They are, because the Chinese are doing more of the Admiral Mayer build a little, test a little, learn a lot routine. We just keep progressing from breaking our nose on a rake, the nose heals, we step on another rake and break it again. It was just really impressive for me to, one, see that she's, somebody slipped a pod under her cot and she's turned into one of those people. And two, this is going to be the influential people helping to staff up the Biden Pentagon, if that's the direction the American voters decide to take us. It was just depressing. And it's not political. It's all military.
Yeah. Someone I read somewhere has come up with the idea that if we get, I'm just going to talk surface Navy for a while, for a minute, because We go through admirals too fast. If you've got ComNav Surface Forces, Commander Naval Surface Forces Pacific, leave him in the job for 6 years, 7 years. I mean, the reason the Soviet Union built a pretty reasonable service force was because Admiral Gorshkov, whatever his name was there forever. I mean, he you know, it's sort of like having Rick over for the submarine force. He was there forever, and you get somebody with continuity of leadership like that, you get rid of these fly-by-night ideas, and you stop people thinking their next promotion is going to come if they come up with this one brilliant idea that they can put down on paper, and it will only be executed after they're long gone by people who have to try and figure out what the brilliant idea really meant and what it means when it hits the street. I think the senior surface leadership needs to be stabilized for a period of time, where they let these guys work to what do we really need? Let's get it done. Let's be professional about how we do it, and get the shipyards where they should be, and demand a quality product from the manufacturers. And we're not going to change requirements midstream, as we've done on so many of our shipbuilding projects, where we keep adding this and that and all that. You know, that's the advantage of those frigates that we're getting from a European design. If you don't change too much, we can get a really good product out of that.
Yeah, that turnover, I think, is responsible for some of our inefficient and ineffective programs, is that for some reason, maybe it's because they're trying to build their name for the next position, I don't know, but everybody that comes in feels like they need to have their stamp on it. It's a personality-based leadership style vice more of a leadership style based upon the organization, and we whipsaw back and forth. But you're right, having the right person in a place for a long period of time gives you that continuity. I guess maybe the problem is it's hard to find the right person to do it, but even if you did, you can't keep them there too long. That was the amazing thing about 2 to 3 year orders, is especially in peacetime. It takes you 6 months to get settled, and 6 months before you leave, you almost become ineffective because people know you're due to roll. So that gives you that juicy center in the middle that you can really do a lot of work. That's less than one cycle. It's especially with folks in the job for just 24 months. That's a hard way to really have any type of sustainment on a system.
If I were in power, I would appoint a surface Navy czar. You know, you're the czar. You deal on it. Of course, I hate the word, and we've done all this with energy czar and all that stuff. But anyway, you're the king of the surface Navy, and you know, you get the best people working for you, and you reward them the way we can reward people who are the best people, and we'll take care of you. Of course, your CNOs, I think that's a too short a tenure too, but I'm just an old grumpy guy. Speaking of old grumpy guys, I've been having fun with Venezuela lately. Have you been watching what's going on there? The U.S. has seized apparently three loads of oil that were supposed to go to Venezuela. You're going, well, why are we importing oil to Venezuela?
Did we seize it, or did we convince the owners to divert? I couldn't get detail.
Well, I don't know. The Iranians think we seize it because they're looking for it. They're trying. They've been assaulting ships in the Straits of Hormuz or someplace, trying to find their oil. They're missing oil. A million barrels of oil has gone missing. Apparently seized by the U.S. somewhere along the way. And the other thing is, looking at this article the other day, and it says Venezuela oil production is close to zero. Here's another one of these oil-rich countries, hugely, yeah. And they're producing almost no oil. And how does that happen?
Well, there's a great lesson here. prosperity isn't your birthright, or as my late great father used to say, nobody owes you a living, son. And, you know, Venezuela to have one of, if not the highest per capita GDP in all of Latin America. And they didn't go the Norwegian route. Norway also is very petroleum rich, but they've been very responsible with their income and have invested it, and they're not a corrupt nation to begin with. But Venezuela went the opposite route, and to put a cherry on the cake, decided to go socialist with a nationalist tinge to it and roll that in with some corruption, and there's no incentive. It's all incompetence on who runs things. And from what some oil people have told me, Venezuela doesn't have, you know, West Texas light sweet crude that looks like, you know, somewhere between apple juice and honey. They have this sulfur rich, dark, dank, almost like bunker oil that's very difficult to
sour crude.
Yeah, sour crude.
It's called sour.
It's hard to refine. And a lot of those refineries are actually in the U.S. who can actually refine that oil. And when they got frustrated, because when you buy votes and you can't produce the money to answer your promises, you start seizing stuff. When they started nationalizing their oil industry, they didn't have responsible people there that knew that, okay, we made you know, $500 million this quarter. We've got to take $200 million of that and invest it in new equipment and maintenance of existing equipment, or 2 years from now, that stuff's going to stop working. They said, no. Instead, we're going to take that $200 million and we're going to buy everybody a new pair of shoes. But if you do that, we're not going to have any oil in 2 years. Well, I'm going to be moving here in 18 months to another government organization, you know, getting promoted. So what the hell do I care? Shut up and take this bribe. You do that for long enough, and your oil industry just screeches to a halt. And if you make the wrong enemies, and those enemies all of a sudden make it hard for you to get spare parts when you want it, or make your ships disappear on the high seas, well, sucks to be you. Pick better enemies next time.
Yeah, the Oil and Gas Journal, you know, they're saying Venezuelan crude oil production is currently 100,000 to 200,000 barrels per day and falling. Production was around 650,000 barrels per day just a year ago and has been as high as 2 million barrels per day as recently as 2017. It's conceivable that it could be producing zero. The country is now the third smallest oil producer among OPEC's 13 members, just ahead of Equatorial Guinea and Libya, war-torn Libya. So...
The Chavista phrase, socialism or death. Why do you feel like you have to choose? You can have both. It's okay. It's a lesson. It's a lesson that they'll just have to be an example to other people. I just feel sorry for the Venezuelan people. You know, where I live, we have a not insignificant percentage of Venezuelans who have immigrated here. Of course, they are, you know, the doctors, the lawyers, the Indian chiefs, those who could afford to leave. There are just a lot of people in Venezuela who are no different than you and me, who are just suffering so bad because they and their countrymen decided to elect the wrong people. That happens sometimes in republics. The future isn't guaranteed. Every generation has to strive to make it better, and the Venezuelans chose poorly. How do you turn that around? Oh, hell, I don't know. Declare war on Brazil and Colombia, let them invade and conquer it and reset everything? I don't know, but Colombia and the Brazilians have enough troubles of their own. I don't think they want Venezuela. Lord knows we don't.
Yeah, I just am... you know, there is a way to do it, but it involves, you know, changing the whole scheme of the way their government, and I'm sure that we don't need to be involved. The United States does not need to be involved in changing any more governments anytime soon, despite
now,
what the government of Venezuela keeps claiming.
Yeah, here's one thing that maybe you can help me with this, because I keep going round and round with these people. Back in an old age, we used to do military intervention, for United Fruit Company or other such spurious things. No, that was a robber baron era of 100 plus years ago, whatever. Then, you know, we have intervened here and there for reasons like we've done in a few African places with the UN, just trying to help people out. And during the Cold War, we got involved in a lot of interventions because, well, you had communist forces who were trying to dominate the globe, and you have to do what you have to do. But there is an instant tendency in our foreign policy establishment to think that every problem in the world needs a U.S. military solution. When in 2020, I don't see there being much juice that we're interested in worth a squeeze in places like Venezuela or other places around the world where certain people really, 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 really want us to get involved in another conflict. I can't think of
it. Yeah,
any.
But who
are the serious people that want to make a case for military intervention in Venezuela? Or is this all just Venezuela waving the Yankee boogeyman to keep their people under control?
Well, I think it's the boogeyman is part of it. The other part of it is there are people, and I think Susan Rice is one of them, who would love this humanitarian intervention. You know, we're gonna invade you to protect you from yourselves. Thing, you know. Well, that got us Libya. That got us Syria. It got us a lot of other things that we wish we hadn't been involved in, but you know, there's a big group of people that support that kind of activity.
Well, Susan Rice has a military-aged male as a son. He can be the first one across the beach. Then see what you think about it. Then
yeah.
You've got skin in this game with your sons, and I just. Damn it, we need to be stingy with the lives of our young men and women. And there are people who don't have the skin in the game who think it's really neat to pull PowerPoint slide number 23 through 37 on a whim or a theory. Forget about the people who live in these countries who either we kill or are killed by our proxies or second and third order effects. You know, but the kids from Iowa, North Carolina, Massachusetts, California, you know, we should be really stingy with those lives because you did it, and I did it, and a lot of our listeners here. When your orders come in, you don't really care where you're going or what you're doing. You just plain do it, and you trust that those that are telling you to do it are making the right call. Venezuela ain't worth it.
So few things are that are not on our shore, but. You know, it does make sense to protect democracies that need protection. And, you know, that the trouble is that I suspect we're going to see, you know, the Chinese have been cozying up to Venezuela, too. So that is another one of those concerns. I don't know if they're as involved now as they were before, but... just another one of those exciting things that happens around the world when the Chinese look for ways to have some resources.
Yeah, the Russians and the Chinese, they both look for unstable areas that they can kind of try to tweak our tail, so to speak. part of it thinks they're just trying to get us involved in someplace else. Who knows? I don't see how the Chinese make $1.05 for every dollar they would invest in a place like Venezuela. Maybe they do, but man. What a mess.
Yep.
Speaking of messes, we've gone over our 1 hour.
Oh, no.
Things we didn't talk about. Here, we haven't done this before on our melee. These are the things on my list that we didn't talk about. One, I have a bee in my bonnet over silly people in the Pentagon that want to bring back nuclear-armed cruise missiles on surface ships. I just think that's stupid. In theory, we have a new SecNav. I have no idea what he thinks or what he's spending his time doing. And all those people that are talking about how carriers are dumb and stupid, then why are the South Koreans, Chinese, Japan, France, and everybody else trying to build one? And I'll keep beating this drum until everybody agrees with me. All you people that think you're going to grow the Navy by just getting a larger Department of Defense pie, you're smoking something that you should probably pass around. You're not going to get a bigger pie. If you want more money, you're going to have to argue and fight and claw to get a larger part of that pie. And there are people who get it, but not enough. But we can talk about that on some other melee.
Yeah, I think that's one of the topics that we should, and was raised early by somebody in the chat room, was how are we going to beat the drum to get the Navy a bigger, I mean, we know the defense budget will be cut depending on who wins the election. And if it is cut, how are we going to make sure the Navy gets more than the what's all divided equally among the services? Some services don't need that money right now, and the Navy sure does.
Yep. Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, Eagle One. And Scott and Paul, it's good to see y'all in the chat room. And I tried to keep an eye on things. If y'all had a question that we didn't address, well, by all means, let us know. And next melee, we'll make sure and address it. And thank you, everybody else, for joining us for another edition of Midrats, who are with us live or are you catching the podcast. We really appreciate your time and interest. And if you've made it this long, that means you're a fan of the show. And if you haven't already, go over to iTunes or either blog, wherever you get your podcast. Give us a 5-star rating. Give us a few sentences about how wonderful we are. If you don't like our audio quality, quit complaining about it. We do the best we can for the price you pay. But we'd appreciate it if you could show it. That would give an opportunity for other people interested in national security, if they're looking for podcasts, that will pop up in their search. Anything you got, Eagle One?
No. Have a splendid Navy week, 2 weeks, month, day.
Amen. And everybody keep your air conditioning on and wash your hands. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.